Good morning. My name is Rich Farrell. I'm a professor at the University of Saskatchewan. And my talk today is about this FTIR-based system that we've been using to do sort of semi-continuous measurements of greenhouse gases in agricultural fields. But primarily our interest is nitrous oxide, and that's what this talk is going to focus on, is the N2O portion of all of this. So, I mean, typically we know that the majority of measurements are made using chamber-based systems, and usually are manually sampled systems with static chambers. The advantages are they're sort of relatively inexpensive, relatively simple to use. You can deploy fairly large numbers of chambers. We've had as many as 120 out in a field at any one time. Disadvantages are they're sort of labor-intensive, and they have fairly poor temporal resolution. There's only so many times you can go out during a year. There's only, basically, you're out once a day primarily, especially if you have remote sites. And so while automated systems have been around for CO2 for quite a number of years and have been successfully deployed, the technology for N2O always seemed to be lagging a little bit. But over the last decade, 7 to 10 years, there's been a lot of change in that. There's been a lot of advances technologically, and there are now a lot of N2O sensors available that can be incorporated into automated systems. If you go out to the exhibition hall, there are quite a few of them on display here of the different types of systems that are available. And the advantages are you get this near continuous measurement, you get really good temporal resolution, but they're expensive, they require energy, you can't put quite as many of them out, so there's that trade-off on temporal versus spatial resolution. And when we started this, Reynolds Lemke, who's with Ag Canada and is my collaborator on this, we started thinking about what, if we move to this and get higher temporal resolution, what does that mean in terms of our old data? We've got 20 years worth of data with manual chambers, and if we now move to an automated system, are we going to be getting comparable results? What does it mean in terms of the data that we already have that we're making comparisons to? So our primary goal in this was to compare N2O flux patterns and cumulative emission estimates with the manual and automated systems. And we did this in the context of a larger study that's looking at N management in irrigated canola. And so essentially what we did is we put paired chambers out in plots that have a split application of urea at the rates from 0 to 220 kilograms N. So there's one manual chamber and one automated chamber sort of sitting side by side, a couple of rows apart, and we take measurements with those. And so for the purposes of this, I'm just going to look at the 0 and the 220 because that sort of gives the extreme range in the data and sort of the total range of what you could see with the system. So the manual system is basically just this one of these little chambers. It's PVC or plexiglass. This has a 9-inch row spacing, so it's a 9-inch chamber that sits between two rows. We put a lid on. We went out this time 43 times during the year. We typically sample between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. That's when in Saskatchewan, I mean, in the summer, the sun's up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and by 10 or 12 in the afternoon, temperatures are fairly stable. And so that's the time that we usually pick to do our sampling. For this, we were using ambient air as our time zero. We'd take 12 measurements over the course of that 4-hour period, and we'd average them out and use that as our time zero. And for this particular one, we took a single headspace sample at 45 minutes to calculate our flux. Put the samples in excitator vials, return them to the lab, GC analysis, you know, plot the daily fluxes, do area under the curve analysis to calculate the cumulative emissions. The automated chamber system has three main components. There's the GasMet DX4015 FTIR gas analyzer, the Licor 16-port multiplexer, and then the long-term chambers themselves. We started this a few years ago, and so we had custom control software and a controller to allow the FTIR and the multiplexer to talk to one another. And also the communications interface. We also have a data link so that we can check on the status of the system and do data dumps from Saskatoon. This is set up about an hour away from the university, so we can just remotely check in to see if it's working okay. If it's not, there's somebody on station who can go out and sort of work on it to fix anything, and then we can do all of our remote controls and everything from there. The whole system is put into a server rack. It's mounted into a trailer, and it's just left in the field. We were out from basically, this year we went out from seeding and we left out through freeze-up. This is an example of the type of data. This is just an air sample, ambient air from a mast above the trailer that's being pulled through. And then this arrow is when the chamber closes. You can see a little bit of a disturbance here when the chamber closes, so we basically ignore the first 2 minutes. And then you get the increase. You can fit regression line to that, calculate the flux. We go up to about the point prior, one data point prior to when the chamber closes. And then it's flushed with ambient air, and as it just sort of comes back down. And then it starts over with the next chamber moving up. At the same time, it's the LICOR chambers have soil moisture probes and soil temperature probes. So every time a chamber closes, we're monitoring soil moisture and we're monitoring soil temperature. There's also a MET station there, so we get air temperature. We also get rainfall and irrigation. This is at the Canada-Saskatchewan Irrigation Diversification Center, so it's an irrigated study. So we were looking at that as well. So what sort of data do you get? This is from the zero N or the unfertilized plots. And the first thing you notice is just the density of the data. I mean, here we're out 43 times during the year. Here we had 876 measurements over that period. And when you sort of expand out those first 3 weeks, you can really start to see there's a lot more, you get much more detail in here. And some of the things that you start to see are, you know, you've got a peak here. We're picking up the same pattern, but there are differences in how long we're saying an event lasts. This event only lasts a few hours. This one's basically saying it's a much bigger event over a day. So when you extrapolate them out, you're sort of overestimating the value of that event. But we're also starting to see some indications that there are diurnal variations in here. And they're pretty small. But when we move up to the higher end rates, again, you see the temporal variation. You see we're still picking up the same thing. There's two peaks here, there's two peaks here, the big peak here. We're seeing some smaller peaks in here that match up to these. And again, if you expand that data out, you just get to see way more detail in here. So this event here is actually a much shorter, narrower event, and then it comes up again the next day, goes down, comes up, goes down, and you're seeing all of this sort of that sort of more finer scale detail in all of these. And one of the things that you notice is that right off the bat is that we see all of these diurnal variations. As we're coming down here, you don't see anything in this data. But if you look at down here, the temporal data, there's a diurnal change. There's small peaks every day as you come down this curve. And one of the other things that we noticed was that if we went through and we looked at where we got our peak emissions, the peak emissions occur after our sampling window. We sampled between 10 and 2, but peak emissions generally occurred between 5 and 6. So when we looked at every day's data, we would see that in that 10 to 2 window, we were getting a value that was roughly equivalent to the average for an entire day. So it sort of made us feel better that it looks like our data is, we can compare it to some of our older data using this. And at the same time, if you look at this, this is the second peak expanded. And so we've got a point here where we started a high measurement back down the next day. But this is what it actually looks like. This is actually a series of three peak events that occur. And if you sort of go from this top point to the lowest one there, you get a peak that pretty much looks exactly like this, but has all of this area in here that's integrated in and added into the peak, the emission event that actually doesn't occur. So again, we're overestimating what we're seeing from there. So the question was, what effect does that have on the cumulative emissions? And so if we look at the cumulative emissions here, the hatched bars here are the manual sample chambers, the solid bars are the automated sample chambers. And you can see, we see the same event. We can pick out treatment differences. So the two highest fertilizer treatments give the highest emissions, the two lowest give the lowest one. This intermediate one is sort of a little different. The manual chambers basically say that this is significantly different than the two lower ones. The automated chamber says that it's not. And we went back through the data, and this is a result. There's two large peaks, and each one of them is, if you look at them individually and just calculate the amounts in those peak events, this is where the difference occurs. That the manual ones are overestimating what we saw at that point. And so the thing really becomes is how frequently can you manage, can you sample to sort of remove that temporal variability and get a better estimate of these big peak events. The background ones, we're seeing these diurnal variations throughout the year, but they don't really, they're very small diurnal variations, so they don't really add a lot to the cumulative emission. It's these big events that you really need to sort of focus your sampling on and the how frequently you sample. So right now we sample probably three, you know, if we get a big rainfall event or an irrigation event of like an inch or more, we'll go out on three consecutive days to sample. If it's a half inch, we'll go out on two consecutive days. If it's less than a quarter or so, we'll go out just the one day. And that seems to work out a little bit better. We got similar results to this for both the CO2 and methane as well. So we're getting all of that data at once, but it was, you know, 12 minutes, there's only so much you can talk about. And the INTUO is more of our interest anyway. But we did see similar results with the CO2 and methane. And the CO2 data is actually a little bit better. It's just nicer data to work with and everything. But in overall, basically what we found was that it was possible to interface the GasMet FTIR with the LICOR multiplexer in long-term chambers. We were able to get these semi-continuous measurements, so we're getting six or seven measurements off of each chamber each day. When we did this, we were running 20-minute time intervals. Now we're running two more chambers per system, and we're running them at a shorter time interval, so we're running 15-minute time intervals. And we think we could probably go down to, you know, 9 or 10 minutes and still get decent data off of it. The operational and maintenance requirements for the automated system for this one were roughly the same as those to a conventional automated CO2 system. They weren't very much. The FTIR worked really well. We had it in the field for 2 years. We do zero checks and calibration checks every cycle. So that once we've done all 10 chambers or all 12 chambers, then there's a zero check and a calibration check, and it'll repeat that every time it goes through one whole series of chambers. So we'll get three or four of those, or well, six or seven of those every day. And we found that we were trying to look for drift, and we didn't see very much drift. The FTIR was really stable. We basically had it in the field for 2 years. We calibrated it. It was factory calibrated when we received it, and a year, 2 years later, our calibration curve was almost exactly the same. The first time through, our slope versus the GC was 1.01, and 2 years later was 0.998. So it was a really stable instrument. So that worked out really well. From just an emission standpoint, what we were finding were that emission events peak later in the afternoon than we usually sample. And because our manual sampling is early, that was something that we were sort of concerned about, but right now we don't really see it as being much of a problem. What we also noticed is that event windows can vary quite a bit. So frequently when you're manually sampling, you're out there daily, but the event windows can actually only last a few hours. So it's important to sort of take that. The temporal resolution is an important part of this. And that the total emissions from an individual event, and really it's from an individual large event, tended to be overestimated with the manual sampling system, and that you really, how much you overestimate depends upon how frequently you can actually get out and manually sample the chambers, and it decreases with sampling frequency. But that the cumulative emission estimates obtained using the two systems weren't significantly different, and we're really happy with this. Right now we're using the automated system on subsets of samples, and then because we can remotely access into it, we can sort of say we should be out sampling soon, as soon as this rainfall event, or when it ends, you can sort of see with the automated data when you're back down to zero and you can stop sampling. So we're sort of using it to sort of guide our sampling on the manual systems. At this point, I just want to thank the funding agencies and the people who helped make all of this possible. And at that point, I'll take any questions.
We have 1 minute for questions.
Yeah. How does the automated system work for an warm up during the winter or spring breakup period when it's open to freezing?
That year we didn't have it out there. We did have it out during the spring thaw this past year, and it worked fine. We were out there from, you know, well, our spring thaw started in sort of late April. But we were out where we'd have overnight temperatures that were below zero, and the chambers worked fine. We seemed to get pretty good data off of it.
Okay.